how do we preserve the rules of war in the digital realm? Well, my guest today is the legal advisor at the International Committee of the Red Cross, where he leads the legal and policy efforts on the Digital Emblem Project, which is an ambitious initiative reimagining what that Red Cross emblem means in cyberspace. And for over 160 years, that Red Cross emblem has served as a universal signal of protection, protection for medical and humanitarian services in all times of armed conflict. But now, as that battlefield is expanding into networks and code, they're asking, can a digital marker play the same life-saving role online? The goal is not about rewriting the rules, but to apply international humanitarian law to modern threats. So that could mean marketing protected digital assets like hospitals' networks, humanitarian logistics systems, and ensuring that they are visible to cyber operators and recognised as simply off-limits in any armed conflict. So my guest, his name is Samit. He's going to walk us through the project's legal underpinnings, the technical approaches being explored, and the real risks and challenges such as visibility versus vulnerability, and how collaboration is critical to success. And with support coming from Microsoft, cybersecurity firms, and hundreds of other tech companies via the Cybersecurity Tech Accord, I also want to create a call to action for anyone in the tech industry to play a part in this too. But here's the question. Can trust, legality, and technology, can they all come together in time to protect those who rely on digital systems for life-saving work? That's right, this is your call to action. But before we get to that point, it's time to introduce you to today's guest. So thank you for joining me on the podcast today. Can you tell everyone listening a little about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I'm Samit Dikuna. I'm a legal advisor at the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the ICRC, headquarters in Geneva in Switzerland. As a legal advisor, I cover many of our files related to cyber warfare and outer space, but really the work nearest and dearest to my heart is leading the legal and policy aspects of the very new and exciting Digital Emblem Project, which I have the pleasure of speaking about a little bit more with you today.
Fantastic. Well, there's so much I want to talk with you about today, because one of the things that I try and do every single day on this podcast is get people thinking differently about areas that technology is impacting our life, their work, and indeed our world in ways that you don't automatically maybe think about or associate with technology. And if I take the Red Cross emblem, for example, long being recognized in physical conflict zones, but not necessarily associated with technology. So what was the catalyst for creating a digital counterpart, and why is it needed now?
Yeah, so absolutely, Neil. The Red Cross emblem, also the Red Crescent and Red Crystal, has been a powerful symbol of protection, recognized across borders, languages, and cultures for over 160 years. But as warfare has evolved, so has, of course, the battlefield. Today, we're seeing hospitals, humanitarian organizations, even aid supply chains being targeted not only by bombs, but by bites. Right, through cyber attacks. So one catalyst for the digital emblem was this very shift, a growing number of cyber operations targeting healthcare and humanitarian organizations during armed conflict. So what the digital emblem is about is extending the same recognition and legal protection that the physical emblem offers into cyberspace. It's a way of saying, this is a protected entity, don't target it. But the truth is, it's not just about cyber operations, right? Digital infrastructure has really always been, since its inception, essential to the work of the medical services and humanitarian operations, and increasingly more so. I mean, today we depend on the internet to provide life-saving assistance to those most in need. And so where the medical services and humanitarian operations go, well, logically, so too must a way to signal their very specific and important protection under the laws of war. So today, the physical emblem is used for personnel. It's used for vehicles like ambulances. It's used for medical ships or planes, for hospitals. So it's only logical that as the medical and humanitarian sectors increasingly depend on cyberspace, there must be a way to signal its protection through cyber means as well. And that's really at the heart of the Digital Emblem Project.
And it's such an important point to raise, especially at a time of increased global conflict. And a great point you made there about being targeted by bits and bytes, not just bombs. And I think cyber operations during armed conflicts have increased dramatically as of attacks on critical infrastructure and all the software and technology that that critical infrastructure sits on. So can you just give me a sense of how medical and humanitarian entities are being targeted in today's digital backgrounds? Because it is something we're seeing more and more, sadly, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the digital battleground is very real. And unfortunately, healthcare has been on the front lines. We've seen cyber operations that, you know, as I mentioned, disable hospital IT systems in war zones, knocking out critical infrastructure like electronic health records or even life support equipment. And sometimes, you know, these are, you know, they're not just accidents, they're deliberate operations. And they have a real significant human cost that we've increasingly been documenting. And, you know, during armed conflicts, humanitarian organizations really rely on digital tools, everything from logistics software to communication platforms. When these systems are compromised, it's not just an IT issue. I mean, it really does put human lives at risk. So it's really not theoretical anymore. It's something that's happening right now and something that the international community and the ICRC in particular is really taking quite seriously.
And despite that old saying of all is fair in love and war, there are strict laws in place to prevent a lot of this kind of thing happening. So, but for listeners that are unfamiliar with international humanitarian law, what legal protections would this digital emblem convey? And how do they compare to protections maybe in the physical world that people are aware of?
Well, that's a really great question. So, I mean, in the physical world, the Red Cross emblem signals protection under international humanitarian law during armed conflict. So it can be used by the medical services of the armed forces, right? So the medical services of the parties to the conflict themselves. It can be used by civilian medical services. And then it can also be used by what we call the components of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. So the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the International Federation of the Red Cross, or the national societies like the British Red Cross or the Turkish Red Crescent or others. And so for one thing, it tells anyone participating in hostilities, do not shoot. This is a hospital, it's an ambulance, it's a humanitarian worker. That's sort of the role that most people know about. But actually, it does a lot more than that, because it also signals something that we lawyers, we call a specific protection under international humanitarian law. And in this case, what it signals is the obligation of parties to conflict, including when they are states, to not only not shoot, but also to respect and protect. That's the legal terminology. Respect and protect the medical services and certain humanitarian operations. And so this positive obligation means that parties to conflict must not only not shoot, they must take proactive steps to make sure that the medical services and certain humanitarian operations continue to function, even in the complex security environments that present themselves in armed conflict. So, you know, these obligations are over 160 years old today, but to bring it to today, the digital emblem aims to serve that same purpose, just in cyberspace. And so if an entity is marked with the digital emblem, what it's saying is that this server, this system, this domain, it's protected under the laws of war. And the emblem, well, it doesn't create new laws, just like the physical emblem didn't create new laws. What it does is it helps apply existing protections to the digital domain. So it's about recognition, it's about distinction, and ultimately what it's really about is restraint.
And from a technical perspective, if we take a look under the hood, what kinds of markers are being considered to implement in the emblem? Are we talking DNS entries, certificates, metadata? And if we are, what are the pros and cons of each of the things that you're looking to implement here?
Well, so we've been working on the digital emblem for about 4 years now. And when we started out, we really started looking at some of the big picture options, like setting aside dedicated IP ranges for protected systems, or even creating whole top level domains just for humanitarian infrastructure. But pretty quickly, we realized that that kind of centralization doesn't really align with the decentralized nature of how the Red Cross and Red Crescent emblems work in the physical world. So if you look at history, getting into too much of the sort of gory details, the truth is that the Red Cross was chosen because theoretically any wounded soldier or any person who's treating a wounded soldier would have access to the color red and would be able to paint an emblem should the need arise, you know, on a battlefield or in a complex environment. And so the idea was really to decentralize the emblem as much as possible because that would increase protection. And so instead, what we leaned on is a solution proposed by ETH Zurich, a university in, of course, in Zurich in Switzerland that uses cryptographic certificates. And these allow us to build what's called a chain of trust. So from a server that carries the emblem, you can actually trace the endorsement all the way back to a national authority that has digitally signed off on it. And that gives us authenticity, accountability, and importantly, decentralization all at once. It also gives us flexibility. So for example, the emblem can be verified by systems that recognize it, but it can also be hidden or withdrawn if needed, depending on the level of risk. So we're really designing it so that inspections can be also covert, meaning no one can tell if a system is being checked or not. That kind of helps avoid turning the emblem into a honeypot. And it also happens to be exactly, once again, how the physical emblem works if you think about it. So if a hospital, for example, displays the physical emblem, well, the hospital doesn't know when militaries are looking at its emblem. And there are really cogent reasons, both legal, operational, and practical, that make it so that that absolutely has to be true for the digital emblem as well. And generally, as part of the IETF standardization process, we're actually focusing on DNS really as the main distribution mechanism, because it's, you know, it's lightweight, it's global, and it fits well within the existing infrastructure.
And you mentioned there around avoiding turning areas into a honeypot. And I think introducing a digital marker could introduce potential risks as well. So how is the ICRC approaching the challenge of making these emblems detectable, but without making the systems more vulnerable? Because I would imagine that is quite a tricky balance.
Yeah, this is a concern, and it's something that we've talked about a lot. So we've had several consultations with states, with militaries directly, with cyber commands, with different sort of groups that engage in hacking online. We've engaged with the medical services. We've, of course, engaged with the technical sector, and it's sort of a complex answer. So, I mean, on the one hand, there's, you know, a worry that marking a system with a digital emblem might actually make it more visible to attackers. But in reality, what we see and what we understand from experts in our consultations is that if someone wants to find critical infrastructure, they already have the tools like Shodan, Census, and others that can scan the internet really pretty effectively. So we don't believe actually that the emblem adds significant exposure, especially because it's paired with legal protection. So state actors, as parties to the Geneva Conventions, are legally bound to respect it. And for criminal groups, there's a potential deterrent effect. So for example, misusing the emblem, for example, could under proposed new legislation be considered a serious international crime. So it's one of the reasons that, of course, integrating the digital emblem into international and domestic law is so important, the same way that the physical emblem is integrated into domestic and international law. But that being said, we're building in safeguards. So as I mentioned before, the emblem can be turned off temporarily if the situation gets too risky. And again, that mirrors how the physical emblem works. So it doesn't need to be used at all times. And it's ultimately up for an individual entity to make its own security analysis of what works best for it, whether it's displaying the emblem or not. That's also true for the ICRC. You know, when we work in environments like armed conflict, there are certain situations where we might not actually display the emblem because the risk is too high. So we really look at the emblem the same way the medical sector and others do, as a tool. And so this doesn't change the protection that's accorded under the law, right? Because it only signals the protection. And so to guard against misuse, like someone falsely claiming protection, we're also exploring technically tools like certificate transparency, which would allow auditing and monitoring of how these digital certificates are being issued. So, you know, in summary, it's really about striking the right balance, you know, visible enough to be respected, but not so visible that it invites trouble.
And I also read that the Internet Engineering Task Force is discussing a working group for the emblem too. So if we look to the broader space here, what has the response been from the broader tech community so far? Have people been eager to get involved?
Yeah, honestly, we've been really humbled by the response. There are several tech companies that are really interested in the Digital Emblem project, notably Microsoft, which has taken a huge interest, but also many others. And you mentioned the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF. Of course, the IETF is a community, you know, really known for its rigor. We've had very productive conversations. I mean, tough conversations, but really good productive conversations, especially through this proposed working group to define the technical standards for the emblem. Outside of the IETF, the cybersecurity community has really shown support in our conversations so far. People recognize the humanitarian value, but also raise really smart questions about implementation, about spoofing, and also about those unintended consequences that we just discussed. So that's exactly the kind of scrutiny we absolutely need, because eventually, you know, the technical solution that we find is a technical solution that will bring to to states, and we want to integrate into international humanitarian law. I mean, we want to sort of continue the story of the Geneva Conventions by potentially having a new treaty or amending an existing treaty or an annex of a treaty. So, you know, it's really important work. And so we really want everything related to the technical development to be open, to be peer-reviewed, and to really be collaboratively built. Because, like I said, if it's going to work, it has to work for everyone. Last year, I'll just mention at the International Conference of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent. So this is a conference that takes place once every 4 years, sort of like the Olympics for, let's say, international humanitarian law. It brings together all 193 states parties of the Geneva Conventions. And at that international conference in October of last year, states adopted a unanimous resolution encouraging continued work on the digital emblem project by the ICRC. And only a few weeks later, the Cybersecurity Tech Accords adopted a digital emblem pledge, equally pledging support for the project. The Tech Accords is a group of over 100 tech companies. Again, it includes Microsoft, Mandiant, and several others from all over the world that are committed to improving the security, stability, and resilience of cyberspace. So that support has also been really invaluable and sort of has shown the different disciplines that are very much coming together to support and be a part of this work.
And as you said there, if it's going to work, it must work for everyone. And this initiative is built on multilateral collaboration. So how are governments, humanitarian actors, and indeed cybersecurity professionals and tech professionals being brought into this process? And what kind of feedback has shaped the development so far?
Yeah, we're engaging across different sectors, right? So as I mentioned, a lot with governments, a lot with the private sector, and a lot with civil society. And there's reasons for that. I mean, governments are crucial, as I mentioned, for the legal recognition. Humanitarian actors help ground the digital emblem in real world needs. And cybersecurity professionals keep us sound on the technological front. So one thing we've heard loud and clear, for example, is do not reinvent the wheel. We've heard that from states. We've heard that from the tech sector. And so we're really building on existing protocols. And as you can probably tell from our chat, we're also constantly inspiring ourselves from how the physical emblem works every step of the way and trying to mirror that as much as possible. Another thing we've heard a lot is make sure you design for failure. And so even if someone ignores the emblem or tries to spoof it, we really do everything we can to try and minimize the risks and incorporate that into the technical development and also into sort of the legal and policy discussions and way forward. You know, this work has also really helped the ICRC, an organization that is over 160 years old, evolve in the way it works. Because, you know, when it comes to our work on the digital emblem, you know, as you mentioned, it's multilateral. It's also so multidisciplinary. You know, there's so many people from all walks of life that are really coming together for this important cause. And I think that's what really makes it so exciting and challenging for us and for me in particular.
And if we do dare look a little further ahead, what do you think success would look like for the Digital Emblem Project? Is it widespread adoption, technical implementation, legal recognition, or is it all of the above or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's honestly all of the above. I mean, we need the digital emblem to be integrated into international humanitarian law. So we're working closely with states on kickstarting that process once we advance on the technical standards. We need also domestic implementation. So we're working with the local components of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent movement, what we call national societies all over the world. And actually, the Australian Red Cross has really taken an important lead on many of these conversations with the different national societies. We also need, of course, the tech sector to adapt to the important changes that we've envisioned. So we're working so much with the private sector, you know, across different fora as well. So like I said, you know, really multidisciplinary. And also, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I work with a colleague who's a technical expert. You know, we don't always understand each other. So it's about having those conversations where we're really able to sort of speak the same language. It's been quite interesting. So I think it's really all of the above in that sense. I'll maybe add one more thing that's really, really important for the success of this project. And it really mirrors, again, the distinctive emblem, the physical emblem. This project requires a trust to succeed. I mean, medical and humanitarian workers who put their lives at risk in conflict, they need to be able to trust that when they display the emblem, it's respected. States and parties to conflict need to be able to trust that their medical services will be protected too, even by the adversary. And they will need to be able to trust that when it's their own armed forces that are hurt, that the medical services and the humanitarian operations are equipped to help. So for many of the risks and doubts about the digital emblem, they mirror almost perfectly the risks and doubts that states and others asked 160 years ago, when that very first Geneva Convention was adopted in 1864. I mean, they asked the question of, will parties respect the emblem? Will it put the medical services more at risk? Will it really save lives? I mean, we see this in the drafting history. States really negotiated this 160 years ago. But the story of the emblem 160 years later, I mean, it's completely uncontroversial. It's become a universal symbol of protection known and recognized everywhere and has saved countless lives. And a big reason for that is trust. And so more than anything, you know, we're at an inflection point where if the digital emblem is going to succeed and have a similar story, that's what success needs to look like. It needs to have trust.
What we're talking about here is an incredibly serious topic, and quite rightly too. But before I let you go, I'm going to try and have a little bit of fun with you here, because you've earned your stripes out in the tech field and done some fantastic work. And what is the funniest or most interesting story that has happened in your career? I'm sure there are many, whether it be legal or technical and everything in between. Is there anything you can share before I let you go?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I have a few in mind, but I think I have a good one that I'd like to bring it back to tech in a second. But if it's all right with you, I'll shift us to sort of the physical world in a second, because I think it gives us an idea of how the emblem is used in the physical world. When I talk about humanitarian operations, when I talk about, you know, what is this life-saving work that takes place in armed conflicts, I think it really ties into that. But it's also, hopefully, kind of a funny story. But before I settle down to the much calmer lifestyle and atmosphere of Geneva, so here in the headquarters of ICRC, I actually started my career with ICRC in what we call the field. So working in countries and regions that are affected by armed conflict. And one place I worked was in Colombia. And one of the things that the ICRC does in Colombia, actually, for me personally, one of the most rewarding aspects of my job, even to this day, is what we call humanitarian recuperation. So we actually reunite families with the remains of their loved ones, because their loved ones have been lost. And sometimes those remains are buried in very isolated places. So we often, you know, as a big ICRC team, have to go very far in the jungle or in very isolated places to sort of undertake these recuperation missions and bring closure to families that have been waiting, you know, years or sometimes decades to know more. And so you can imagine the conditions. I mean, it's hot, it's muggy, there's bugs and snakes everywhere. We've been sleeping in hammocks for days and traveling on horseback. And there was this one time that we were, you know, looking for these remains, and we had spent sort of the whole day trying to find them, and we weren't exactly sure where they were. And my Spanish, I was still sort of working on my Spanish at the time. And all of a sudden I heard my colleagues, they started talking about something, you know, they started saying huevito. And huevito, I mean, literally what it means is little egg. So I was like, ah, yes, of course, everyone's hungry. I was certainly very hungry. And I was like, okay, great. We're going to take a break. We're going to go get food soon. And then what I started to understand is what they were saying was, we need to go. There's a village nearby, a small little village of a few houses nearby. And we need to go get huevito. And I was like, okay, we want to go over there and get eggs. And, you know, my colleagues are, you know, the colleagues I worked with were sort of much burlier and bigger than me. So they're a lot better at sort of doing that kind of physical work. So I wanted to be helpful as well. So I said, hey, you know what? No problem. I can go over there. So I actually went over to this village with one other colleague. And when we got to the village, I said, hey, you can wait here. I'll go in and I'll get huevito. And so I go into this village and I just start asking around for eggs. And the people are really confused, and they start explaining to me like, oh, you know, we actually don't have eggs here. And I don't fully understand this, but they were telling me, you know, we have chickens, but they don't lay eggs. You know, they're special or different chickens that don't lay eggs. I don't really know. But we don't have eggs, but we can look around. So we started going to like every single house trying to get eggs, and nobody had eggs. But, you know, people see the emblem, they see the Red Cross, they know that I'm a foreigner. Colombians are so open and friendly, and everyone really wanted to help me, and they saw that I was really committed to getting eggs. So pretty soon I have about 30 people around me kind of moving around the village trying to find eggs somewhere, and everyone's telling me the story about how there's chickens, but you know, they don't lay eggs. And then eventually, after about 10-15 minutes, my colleague who had been waiting for me kind of storms in, and he's like, Simi, what are you doing? Where's huevito? And when he says that, well, there's one person among the 30 that are with me that lifts his hand up, and then then my colleague says, oh, you're huevito, come with us. You know, you can really help us with the work that we're doing. And then I suddenly realized that my colleagues were not looking for eggs. They were looking for a guy that knows where to dig for this, you know, to find the remains. And his nickname is huevito, is little egg. And so, you know, I realize this, but now I've just had, you know, 30 people go on almost literally a wild goose chase with me looking for eggs. So I was like, I need to get out of here as fast as possible. So I can't, you know, we go with this guy and my colleague, and we walk away, and I'm about, you know, 30 steps away, and the entire community, you know, finally dawns on them because they start talking and they just burst out laughing, understanding what had just transpired. My colleagues never let that one go. I mean, my entire time in Colombia, they always reminded me of the Huevito story. But I think the interesting thing about that story, if we, you know, because I did promise to bring it back to the digital, is that, you know, one might not realize, but everything I just talked about, all of that work we do, it actually also depended on digital infrastructure. I mean, our databases where we collect and document the cases of missing persons, you know, that depends on our digital infrastructure. We use digital infrastructure to communicate and plan these kind of operations. We communicate across continents. We communicate with headquarters in Geneva. All of that is done online. Our equipment operates with digital or satellite infrastructure. So really, even in this very specific case of a remote activity in a faraway place, our work depends on the continuity of digital services. And so even for me, you know, this activity shows that the digital emblem is really needed and it's important.
Wow, what a fantastic story. Absolutely love it. I love how you brought it back to digital in the end as well. And as I said at the very beginning, it is a very serious topic, this. And for anybody, any organisation, government, anyone wanting to get involved in this or find out more information, where would you like to point everyone?
Yeah, thanks so much, Neil. I mean, if you're curious to dive deeper into the digital emblem or want to see how the ICRC is working on tech and humanitarian protection, the best place to start is the ICRC's website. So we have a page on the digital emblem. You'll find blog posts. You'll find our expert report from 2022. There's a 4-minute explainer video. It really sort of traces the history of the project up until now and the work that we're doing now. And if you're part of the tech community, you know, we really, really want to hear from you. I mean, if you want to get involved, there are ways to connect with us, you know, on the website or through the work at the IETF. We actively participate in the DIEM group. So the IETF DIEM group, so DIEM is D-I-E-M, digital emblem. We'd really, like I said, love to hear from you. We're always looking for more interested partners and stakeholders on this really important work. So please, please do feel free to get in touch.
And I would second that. I would urge everyone listening to get in touch on anything that they learned from today. I, for one, about protecting medical and humanitarian entities in cyberspace, the importance of creating this digital equivalent of the physical emblem, the technological implementation and feasibility. But more than anything, as you rightly said, for it to work, it has to work for everybody. So if anybody listening is from a government, humanitarian space or cybersecurity professionals, anyone, I'd love for them to get in touch and help develop this. It is such important work. But more than anything, just thank you for shining a much needed light on this today.
Thank you so much, Neil. It's really been a pleasure.
What I took away from this conversation is there is something far bigger than a digital marker or a new cybersecurity protocol being discussed here. At its core, this digital emblem project is a call to extend humanity into cyberspace. We often talk about those blurred lines between the physical and digital world. And I think now it's about ensuring that the protections that we've agreed upon in physical war zones, that they keep pace with the conflicts playing out online. And Samit reminded us that the physical Red Cross emblem didn't become universally respected overnight. It took decades of diplomacy, trust building and shared purpose. And the digital emblem will require the same. Ultimately, it is a multi-stakeholder challenge, one that spans legal frameworks, technical design and global political will. And this, my friends, is exactly where you come in. Whether you are working in cybersecurity, policy, infrastructure or humanitarian tech, this is your moment to get involved. The ICRC has been clear in the conversation today. They've admitted we're not tech experts. They require partners like you in the private sector and open source communities that can help develop a solution that is robust enough to meet legal requirements, but also adaptable enough for the real world. So please, visit icrc.org to learn more. If you're in the standard space, if you're working in government, regulation, humanitarian operations, please don't just think, oh, that was an interesting podcast. I learned a few things. This is your opportunity to actually contribute to shaping how international law is upheld in the digital age. And as the old saying goes, the only way for the bad guys to win is good people sitting around doing nothing. So consider this your call to action, please. What role do you think the tech community, the business community should play in protecting humanitarian services online? Let me know your thoughts as always. Please, let's keep this conversation going. You can connect with me directly on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, just at Neil C. Hughes. So much to think about there, but as I said, don't just think about it. If you want to get involved and take action, please contact them. And I'll be back again tomorrow, hopefully with another thought-provoking set of questions for you. But thank you for listening today, and I'll speak with you all again very soon.